listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Hello, I'm Rob Daly. Thanks for downloading the show. This week, La Liga has a title race again. Barcelona lose and the Madrid clubs win. We discuss Mario Balotelli's unlikely future at AC Milan with Tom Colomossi from the London Evening Standard. Hatem Ben Arfa's ripping it up again in France. Thomas Tuchel makes a big call for Borussia Dortmund as they face Schalke in the derby. We read out your tweets on that. Plus, we're joined by Goal.com's Elliot Rothwell to talk about football in Turkey and Russia.
This is Football in Europe.
Thanks for downloading the show alongside me again, Chris Parrott. Chris, you're back.
I am back, yes. I was in Belgium last week.
What were you doing?
A cycle race. Well, I say race, a cycling event, pottered round and then watched the pros do it the next day.
You had sore hands the next day.
Oh yeah, cobbles all over the place. It was Paris-Roubaix this week. People might know that, might not. And it was the Tour of Flanders last week. It is brutal. And when you watch them going over those cobbles, they glide over them. In fact, I was basically for 8 hours overtaken by fat Belgians on bikes who were born on cobbles. And I was born in Suffolk, so I was struggling.
Well, that's the dream. That's the dream. Chris, we'll get on to La Liga first, I think, on today's show. But we've got to talk about Andy Carroll.
Andy.
So we were at the same TV studio on Saturday morning, and I was giving you fresh grief about Andy Carroll, saying, because people may have heard a couple of weeks ago, you put him in your England squad for the European Championships in France. I said, you know, he's done nothing to deserve that. Defenders deal with him. Then I came to you with fresh arguments after I'd been to the pub with my mate Dave. We haven't got any wingers.
Irrelevant.
It sends out the wrong message to the squad. If you bring a player who's seen as an emergency type player to save you in a certain situation, you'd ignored me.
Yeah.
And then he went and scored a hat trick against Arsenal in what was perhaps the most Andy Carroll thing of all time.
Yeah, just causing total panic. You could see it. I mean, it's Arsenal. I will accept that. And if any team Andy Carroll is going to upset, probably is Arsenal. It's just the way they are. But three goals. He scored against Chelsea the other week. He's not going to start, okay? I'd take him. And if England don't use him, I'd be pleased, because that would mean that we didn't need
a. Do you think he's
going
to go now?
No, I don't think he will.
Oh, okay, right.
I don't think Hodgson. I think Hodgson has, a lot of striking options, because he has probably to take five anyway. Because he's played Welbeck and all those guys in qualifying, and now Vardy has to go. So he's got that issue. As I said, and actually, Smalls, my first time on since that debacle about Daniel Sturridge being
in
my 11.
Yeah, because you obviously put Daniel Sturridge in your starting 11, but didn't put him in your squad.
Yes, yeah.
Which only resurfaced some of the tweets. Derek Patton saying, just about to mention this on you being smug after I tweeted that out from the account. Suddenly, Chris doesn't seem so daft. Remember to put him in the 23 if he's in the 11, though.
Yeah, no, and I realised as soon as I said that, I was like, oh, that means everything else I've, good points, some of them maybe, are totally null and void, because I've done that thing, you know, that's on loop. If you're a politician, you make that sort of error. That's, you know, it doesn't matter what you've said for the next.
Exactly, yeah.
Could have been the most insightful thing in history, but that's all that goes. But I don't think he'll go. I do think as an option, if we need a goal, who better? Just, and the thing about the wingers, I take if he starts, but this is going to be a case of he comes on and the ball goes long. And I know everyone will be like, oh, but if all else has failed and there's no way of we're going to pass through them, or Kane's going to do something brilliant, stick Mandy on, because who knows?
As Mason Lemon says, quoting you, just imagine the chaos from the knockdowns. That is memorable. Okay, so let's talk about La Liga, Chris, because it looks like we have a title race now after Barcelona lost 1-0 at Real Sociedad, and Atletico and Real Madrid both picked up wins. It's all tight at the top.
Yeah, it is. And two defeats in a row for Barcelona, three without a win in the league, which is almost...
dropped 8 points.
Yeah, which is, I mean, totally unheard of under Luis Enrique. And yeah, the gap is 3 points now to Atletico, 4 points to Real Madrid. The title race is on. Barcelona are still big favourites. And I think if you look at the run-in, they have the most favourable. So I still think they'll win the title, but it has made it interesting, which is good. Because
the Madrid-based press in particular, and Marca, the newspaper there, have gone big on the fact that they, I think the front page was, La Liga revived to sort of the front page. Interesting that at the weekend, Luis Enrique rotated. Munir played up front with Messi and Neymar. Arda Turan and Rafinha played in midfield. Sergio Roberto played at left back instead of Jordi Alba. But an early goal from Sociedad winning that game. So you think Barcelona are going to win the title?
Yeah, I think they still will. It's interesting about the rotation. I mean, Real Madrid's, I think it was eight changes in the Wolfsburg loss. Pepe, Casemiro and Ronaldo were the only players. Ronaldo plays every week. And we have to say, first man ever to pass 30 Liga goals in six straight seasons.
Yeah, it's staggering, yeah.
It is an exceptional achievement. But, you know, Barcelona rotated and lost. Real Madrid rotated and won, albeit an easier game. And of course, but they're in a very different position after their defeat to Wolfsburg. So I've had a look at the run-ins. I think Atletico probably have the hardest. They play two of the top six. Real Madrid play Villarreal, one of the top four. Barcelona don't play any of the top six.
Because those top three have all played each other. We've had two Madrid derbies, yeah. We've had the two Clasicos, and Barca have beaten Atletico twice in the league.
Okay, so yeah, very good point. So Barcelona, this is their run in Valencia at home, Deportivo away, Sporting Gijón at home, Real Betis away, Espanyol at home, Granada away.
Yeah, that does seem more favourable than any of those sides the others have got.
Normal Barcelona, and they've got the semi-finals potentially to come, so I'm sure they'll rotate before those if they get beyond Atletico, which is a big if, but you'd back them to win every one of those games. But if they slip up, Atletico, Athletic Club, Malaga, Rayo Vallecano, Levante and Celta, and Real Madrid have Getafe, Villarreal at home, which is their hardest game, yeah. Rayo Vallecano, Real Sociedad, Valencia and Deportivo. It's a shame.
Pretty even. I mean, overall, I know Villarreal, I was really impressed with them in the Europa League the other day. But
as you said, it would have been really good if there was a Clásico or if Barcelona had to play Atletico. Then that would be really exciting.
And Barca do have to play Atletico in the Champions League this week. We'll talk about that later on in the show. And finally, Valencia are safe, almost certainly, because they move up to 12th in the table, 37 points. They're now 9 above the drop zone. That was the concern as they got rid of Gary Neville. Paco Estarán, who worked under Rafa Benitez at Liverpool, is now the manager, a guy that was brought in, allegedly, Neville says by himself, to help out in the backroom staff. They got a late winner at Sevilla, Chris. Alvaro Negredo with a scrappy goal, and it was a much-needed win.
Yeah, it was. Funny, because Negredo was one of the players that Neville brought back in when he first went there, didn't he?
He was
out of favour. But I saw Phil Neville has no longer has matchday duties, though. Or certainly has less and often doesn't travel with the squad and things.
Exactly right. He's been sort of phased out a little bit.
Yeah.
Not a very nice thing. I mean, not his fault.
No, I mean, no. We don't know exactly what he's been doing. That sounds a bit harsher, but, you know, it's under a couple of managers with him there. It hasn't quite gone according to plan. It'd be interesting to see what happens to Phil Neville. He is a man who, you know, has more coaching pedigree than his brother Gary, certainly after his spell under David Moyes at Everton. I wouldn't be surprised if Phil Neville comes back to England in some capacity. I don't know if he'll get a coaching job, but maybe you go into somewhere as a number two.
Maybe wherever David Moyes pops up next, you never know. But he was at the Mestalla at the weekend, Phil Neville, but Chris, absolutely right. No match day duties. So Mestalla went absolutely bonkers when they scored that late winner, by the way, because moments before, Sevilla had levelled through Kevin Gamero with 4 minutes to go. And Unai Emery, former Valencia coach as well, he had good success there. He looked like he wanted to cry at the end. Okay, so we'll move on to matters in Serie A next, because there's lots to talk about from Italy. If you want to tweet us any thoughts about the show, it's at FIE Podcast. And please take the time to leave us a review on iTunes. We really appreciate it when people do that, because it helps us stay in the sports charts. And that means we get more listeners, which is a good thing. Peanut Spurs on iTunes has written a good podcast, a great podcast even, about European football. Long may it continue. And from Kevster29, the podcast has become part of my weekly football schedule. Great analysis and discussion points. Kevster29, you've hit the nail on the head. You're thinking exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah, me too.
Let's go to Italy next.
This is Football in Europe.
Okay, joining us now to talk about Italian football is the Evening Standard writer, Tom Colomossi. Tom, thanks for joining us on the show.
Pleasure, guys.
We'll get on to Italian football, one of your true loves, very shortly. But you're at White Hart Lane for Tottenham's 3-0 win over United. You cover Tottenham for the London Evening Standard. What a result for Spurs.
Yeah, it was a great result and a strange game as well, really, because Spurs were the better team, I think, after a slow start. But that notwithstanding, you didn't really get the impression that Manchester United were having a number of problems with them. I mean, I've seen a lot of performances from Spurs this year where they've really blown away the opposition. But for most of the first half and then the first half of the second half, that wasn't the case. And then when Dele Alli scored, it just, the dam burst completely. And yeah, they showed a real ruthless streak that I think it is a hallmark of a lot of the top teams. I'm not sure it's going to be enough for them to win the league this season, because Leicester just are so relentless, aren't they? Their structure is so solid that even if they have any nerves, it doesn't seem to, they're so well organised that it seems to be able to override that. All these clean sheets are just remarkable. So while it might not be enough for Tottenham, the future certainly looks bright if they can keep the key men on and off the pitch.
Yeah, it was a really impressive performance. We'll go to Serie A now. It was an emotional night at Milan, though, because of the passing away of Cesare Maldini, who is one of Milan's founding fathers, I guess, and a key man in their history.
Yeah, and a key manager, I suppose, is how I remember him, really. What he did with Milan as a player was obviously marvellous, but I think growing up, I was a late teenager when he was manager of the Italian national team, took him to a World Cup. And probably what most people will remember him for as a manager was that win at Wembley in 1997 in a World Cup qualifier where Gianfranco Zola scored the winner. I think it was Italy's first win at Wembley for many years, since the 70s, I think. And you look back at his legacy as a coach as well. He brought through players in hugely successful under 21 side, players like Alessandro Nesta, Fabio Cannavaro, Francesco Totti, who all went on to become World Cup winners. So I think what his legacy for Italian football is beyond doubt. But maybe as a manager, as a coach, he could have done a little bit more with what was at his disposal. I think if you remember the 98 World Cup, they had quite a lot of talent in that side. There was Roberto Baggio, Del Piero, Maldini, reasonable midfield, people like Francesco Moriero on form, but Albertini, but didn't quite manage to deliver. But I think he'll be remembered as a traditionalist and a real key man in the history of Italian football, mainly because of those guys that he brought through, like Totti, Nesta and Cannavaro.
Yeah, wonderful crowd choreography ahead of the game against Juve. One sang Forever Red and Black, Rossonero, and as well Gone But Not Forgotten, Cesare Maldini. There was also moving pictures of Andrei Shevchenko crying when talking to media outside his funeral in the week. But onto that game, Tom. Milan losing 2-1 at home to Juve. Big win for Juve. Paul Pogba with the winner. Milan did take the lead. And a lot of pressure on AC Milan's head coach as well going into that game.
Yeah, and I think there's a structural problem at Milan that goes far beyond the kind of coaches they're appointing. If you look back, they've been through Max Allegri, who hasn't done too badly since he left there, and I think that was probably their mistake. Probably their mistake getting rid of him, because the year when I think he finished third with them, even though Thiago Silva and Zlatan Ibrahimovic left, was a far greater achievement than maybe we gave it credit for at the time. Since then, they've had Seedorf, they've had Inzaghi, they've had Mihailovic. None of them have really worked out. And now you hear that maybe Christian Brocchi, a former Milan player, might be brought in next year. But you can't really see the difference, any difference it's going to make. I think what they need is serious investment and a proper plan. I think Silvio Berlusconi had this idea of playing a number of young Italians, and I think that's reasonable. So they've had players like Bonaventura who've done well this year. Bertolacci's been in and out. Abate is a solid player, but it really lacks the star quality of yesteryear. And I think maybe they need to pursue that avenue, see what's in the academy, rather than what Galliani's guilty of a number of times, just signing these, what's called parametri zero in Italy, where just free transfers. Alex, who scored the winner, was one of those. But I don't think they're going anywhere fast with that plan. So I think if they can stick to some sort of idea of promoting their own, and building from there, it'll take a while to get back to the top, but maybe that's the way forward, rather than just signing random players and hoping for the best.
Yeah, very true. And it's worth noting as well, Gigi Buffon was absolutely outstanding in that game. Perhaps his best performance of the season, in particular, to deny Mario Balotelli on a couple of occasions. Tom, I saw this week that Adriano Galliani, the CEO at Milan, has said that Balotelli hasn't done enough to earn a permanent move. from Liverpool. What are your thoughts on his prospects of staying at San Siro?
My thoughts are that they're quite weak, really. It's a shame because I've always had a soft spot for Mario Balotelli. I think talent is there, and in a sport which is full of these kind of drones who just come out and talking cliches, it's at least an interesting guy. I feel sorry for him in a lot of ways because I think if when we look at sport, we don't necessarily look beyond the ability of the individual. In any society, you're going to get people who are different from others, people who have their own problems related to their backgrounds. And in sport, I don't think that's dealt with quite enough. And I think Balotelli perhaps isn't cut enough slack for the unusual sort of life he's had, really. And I rather fear for his career now. I think you could easily see him, couldn't you? With a lot of money in the Super League in China, you can perhaps see him going over there, maybe to Turkey, somewhere like that. But I think, barring a remarkable turnaround, that probably his career in real top-level football is coming to an end now, which at his age, is very sad indeed. I think only 25, 26 now. It's a pity to see what's happened to Balotelli, because I'm sure we can all remember that semi-final Euro 2012, those two goals against Germany, and you thought, right, here's a player who's really ready to take off now, but it just hasn't happened. And I think people who love Italian football, people who have Italian football at heart, are regretful for that.
Yeah, agreed. Those two goals were amazing, weren't they? One man who this season can't stop scoring is Gonzalo Higuain, suspended for the weekend. I saw the Napoli fans had Higuain masks. 30 goals in 31 Serie A games. First of all, how good is he, I guess? And do you think Napoli will keep him in the summer or not?
It's a difficult one, isn't it? What with these things, you try to look around at who might buy him. There's clubs in the Premier League, but who? I mean, would Manchester United spend on him? I'm not too sure. Manchester City already have Aguero. Arsenal don't really sign that ultra centre forward, do they? The big signings have been Ozil and Sanchez, who are kind of forward players, but not that centre forward. And especially his age now, the price that Napoli would demand for him is going to take somebody who is willing to take a hit, really. And you can't see Real Madrid having him back. You can't see him going to Bayern. You certainly can't see him going to Barcelona. So I just wonder where he might end up. I'm sure he probably wants to go. I'm sure that he probably wants to compete for the big prizes if we think that Napoli aren't going to win the league this year no longer involved in European football. But De Laurentiis is quite a tough cookie, the Napoli owner, and I think if he doesn't want to sell him, he won't. So I could possibly see, unless there's some absolutely crazy offer, which maybe there won't be just because of the age, I could probably see him starting next season at Napoli.
Gonzalo Higuain suspended for the 3-0 weekend win over Hellas Verona. The front three, Gabbiadini, Insigne and Callejon, all scoring for Napoli, but they remain off the pace to Juve after their victory in the Tuscan derby. Empoli beat Fiorentina for the first time in 19 years by 2-0. Paolo Sosa reportedly in talks with Zenit about taking over there from Villas-Boas. Tom, of the weekend, Simone Inzaghi's first game as manager of Lazio. He got a victory at Palermo, but a game where there were some very feisty scenes indeed.
Sad this for Italian football, I think. And while these things keep happening, it's going nowhere fast. You look at these incidences we saw at Palermo last night. There's a firework, wasn't there, launched that I think nearly hit Antonio Candreva. You look at the rows that happened over Higuain's four-match ban. And I think when people look at Serie A from the outside and they see its decline, they assume it's related entirely to the quality of the football, but I think that's to miss the point of it. I don't think that the standard is as bad as a lot of people say. I think that Juventus, had they managed to hold out for another minute against Bayern, they would have been solid contenders for the Champions League this year. Okay, the teams in the Europa League didn't perform so well, but they got absolutely horrid draws. I mean, Fiorentina getting Spurs, Napoli getting Villarreal, who maybe they should have squeezed past, but it's a very credible Spanish team. So I don't think it's so much the action on the pitch that's holding Italian football back. It's everything else. It's incidents like these. Because if you're somebody who wants to invest in Italian football, if you're a foreign broadcaster who wants to promote it, you're going to look at things like that. I think, well, crikey, do I want those images on my TV screen?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's what's really holding it back. And what I worry about is whether there's really the willingness to do anything about it, because we see so many of these incidents year on year, don't we? But nothing really seems to change. And I think there's so many separate vested interests in the Italian game. And if you extend it a bit, looking at the frustrations of Antonio Conte, that he hasn't been able to do the work as a Philly coach that he wanted to do, because the clubs weren't allowing him to have these training camps. And I know that might sound a strange connection to make with what happened to Palermo, but I think nobody's really working together, be they fans, be they the clubs, be they the federation, be they the companies who promote football in Italy. People just think of their own interests. And I think while that lasts, you have a broken system as we have now, and you see incidents like we did at Palermo last night. And I love Italian football. I really want to see it back to where it was in the 1990s. But while this happens, I don't think it's going anywhere fast.
Tom, I know you're out pushing a pram through the cities of London. So thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today, mate. We love having you on.
That's an absolute pleasure. Anytime, guys. Thank you very much.
This is Football in Europe, Bundesliga Roundup.
And a big thanks to Tom for coming on the podcast. We love having his Serie A insight. As always, Chris Parrott, let's talk about Germany. And we'll start with the Ruhr derby between Schalke and Dortmund in Gelsenkirchen. 2-2 it finished. The game sprung to life in the second half. Dortmund twice leading the game. Shinji Kagawa with an outrageous chip that's well worth checking out on a BT Sport Football's Twitter timeline. Wonderful second half. But Dortmund now 7 points behind Bayern. What was interesting, Chris, about this is Thomas Tuchel's decision to rest most of his key players.
Yeah, absolutely. With the Europa League second leg with Liverpool coming, there was no Mkhitaryan, Gundogan or Aubameyang in the starting 11. They did come off the bench, but Marco Reus was an unused substitute. They're their four major players. I think they're four of the best players in European football, certainly on form this season. I totally see why. I get that with Bayern winning, it's probably title over. Realistically, were they going to catch Bayern? I don't think they were. And I think, you know, to win the Europa League, it's scoffed at in this country, but to knock out Liverpool, they've been to two finals in the history of their club and they've never won the competition. And I think for this group of players to win a European trophy, because if Dortmund were in the Champions League, they would be contenders. They didn't, because they were so bad in the first half of last season. But as a group of players to win European silverware, that potentially sets them up. We saw that when I spoke to Jose Mourinho, he said that. He said that Porto win in 2003 in the UEFA Cup was huge, because it gave...
So what, like psychologically?
Yeah, psychologically, it gave them confidence. It gave them all of that experience of winning when they beat Celtic. And then they went on to win the Champions League the next season in Gelsenkirchen, ironically. But, you know, if Dortmund do lift it in Basel, they're definitely in the Champions League. Second spot's assured. I don't know, they'll certainly be contenders again. And also, if you're a Dortmund fan, okay, you haven't won the game and Schalke have come twice back, but also you can rub it in like, yeah, we got a point away and we rested all of our good players.
Well, I think you know, when Schalke saw that team shape, they almost thought, that's a bit of an insult. They think they can get a result here. And they very nearly did. Let's read some of your tweets on this, because we asked today, was it right that Thomas Tuchel rested all his players? He was asked by German TV crew ahead of the game, was this with Liverpool in mind? And he said yes. He was just very honest about it. And I think it's just a bold call. Yep. I like that he thinks, no, I'm determined enough. I think I can get a result with this group of players. And I like managers who want to win trophies. You know, I'm sick of all the top four chasing and all this stuff. That's why the FA Cup's so good in England this year.
Yeah, agreed.
Not to deviate too much. But let's read out some of your tweets anyway. Kenny McFarlane says it was right that Thomas Tuchel made those changes. He said, as winning the Europa League is more likely than winning the Bundesliga. Emphasis now placed on Europa League and on the German Cup. I mean, prior to yesterday, they were on for a treble. It's bizarre. Hashtag great podcast. Thank you very much, Kenny. And La Liga Gav said, I was very frustrated when I saw the lineup. Presumably as a neutral, you know, just to watch the game. But hats off to the second string. They were brilliant. And Pulisic is class. And my word, he looked absolutely brilliant first half, Christian Pulisic. 17 years of age and the United States international, really impressing at Borussia Dortmund. Chris, okay, let's move on to Stuttgart 1, Bayern 3. Routine win for Bayern in the end. Wonderful final goal from Douglas Costa. but a notable incident involving Arturo Vidal in the first half.
Yeah, so they're 7 points clear with five games left. They were nowhere near their fluent best, Bayern, but it was enough to beat Stuttgart. But he wasn't very happy, the Chilean, who's he's one of those players who basically he was going to get sent off, so Pep Guardiola took him off, and he walked straight down the tunnel. But he's that type of footballer, isn't he? He's that all-action central midfielder. Once he crosses the line, he's that, you know, he's not hot-headed, but he controls that aggression.
I think that's fair enough. Yeah, controlled aggression, yeah, generally.
But, you know, if you normally when you say hot-headed, they're going around and they get sent off. But Vidal tends not to, which is partly why he's such an excellent player. But he probably was going to, and Guardiola saw that and took him off. And Mick McCarthy, always to bring it back to Ipswich Town.
Oh, my God. No, but you are not crowbarring Ipswich Town into this section relevant about Guardiola and Vidal.
Actually relevant. So Luke Higham broke Alan Judge's leg on Saturday. Judge is going to miss the European Championships for Ireland. Probably would have made the squad.
Oh, my God.
So he had lost it, and Brentford knew it. And
so he got a yellow for that,
didn't
he?
Yeah, and then he got a second yellow right at the end of the first half. And McCarthy said afterwards, I was going to bring him off at half-time. Well, Guardiola took Vidal off before he could get sent off. Higham gets sent off, Ipswich lose the game. And, you know, Guardiola potentially stopped that happening by taking Vidal off, even if he's not happy with it.
Do you know what? Actually, it makes me think as well of Fernando Torres against Barcelona. He got that yellow card, then he lunged into another tackle, and you're thinking, you've got to be careful here. You just got a yellow moment ago. And then sure enough, he gives the referee a reason to show him that second yellow.
You could see it in his, you know, people say you could see it in his eyes, but you could. He was right on the line, which is probably why he scored and almost set up Griezmann for that second.
Yeah.
But it either needs the coach to take him off. He wasn't going to take Torres off, let's be honest, or somebody just to go up and be like, look,
well,
please do not get sent off, because we saw what happened.
There's a great moment, actually, from the Stuttgart-Bayern game where Vidal gets his yellow and then he goes in for another tackle, and Xabi Alonso, German TV, slowed it down, and Xabi Alonso looks at Vidal in the eyes and goes, when you put your finger to your temple and go,
the Lineker.
Keep it together type thing. And then obviously Pep took his decision to take him off anyway. A quick one, Daniel De Davy scored in that game. He's been absolutely fantastic in attacking midfield for Stuttgart this season. Mm. And he's on his way to Wolfsburg.
Yeah, 11 goals, which for a Stuttgart midfielder is very impressive. He's had fitness concerns, hasn't he? But he looks excellent. He's their main man. That's a coup for Wolfsburg. I think you were saying Stuttgart fans unhappy because he finally got back to fitness and then it's like, okay, now I'm off.
Yeah, a bit of a Michael Owen Newcastle type thing. You commentated on Wolfsburg's 1-1 draw with Mainz, a game between two teams fighting for European football. Going into this, what were the realistic chances that either are going to... Mainz, they're on 45 points, right in the hunt for the Champions League.
Mainz absolutely can still get fourth place or fifth or sixth for the Europa League, which, given their highest ever position is fifth in the Bundesliga, it's going to be a potentially historic season for them. Their coach, Martin Schmidt, we've seen Jurgen Klopp and Thomas Tuchel go through that football club to Dortmund and then be brilliant. He's astute. His players all play for him, absolutely. Basically, if Dortmund conceded the title potentially by their picks or their team selection against Schalke, I think Wolfsburg did. They were 6 points off Mainz.
Conceded what? Their chances of getting in the Champions League?
Certainly conceded their chance of fourth, or picked a team whereby the Champions League is now their number one priority. And who can blame them 2-0 up going to Real Madrid? But Diego Benaglio was out of the squad. Julian Draxler was out of the squad. Then on the bench was Ricardo Rodriguez, Vieirinha, you know, four key men there.
Who need to be absolutely sharp at the Bernabeu. The two fullbacks and their most creative player.
Exactly.
That's very interesting for Dieter Hecking.
It is, yeah. And who can blame him? You know, Draxler has, I think, particularly in the Champions League, he's that player that everyone thinks he can become. And, you know, Wolfsburg might struggle to keep him. I don't know. Obviously signed as the replacement for Kevin De Bruyne when he went to Manchester City, but you know, if he goes to the Bernabeu and shines, then, you know, who knows where he might go.
You know what, I think, given the way that Roma played at the Bernabeu and how they should have scored on the counter-attack, I think Wolfsburg can score there. Mm. And I think Draxler, the way he's been playing with those driving runs through the middle of the pitch, I think they'll get a goal. And then Real Madrid have to bang in four.
Which they might.
that is also true.
You know, Draxler's 22. He seems to have been around forever, but he is only 22, Julian Draxler. And for Wolfsburg's point of view, Bas Dost, who was injured in a training ground challenge by Dante, which...
Well, his own teammate, yeah, is
I mean, it? You can imagine Dante flying in.
He got sent off for the weekend.
Yeah, well, he did. Yeah, it was ridiculous in the last minute. But he, two yellow cards in added on time, basically. But he,
oh, God.
So, but Bas Dost was back for the first time since December. He'd been in the bench for Real Madrid at home, but he gives them, I don't think he'll start the giant striker, but he does give them an option if things aren't going according to
the Carroll role.
The Carroll role. But as you said, if they get a goal at any stage, even if they concede three early goals, they're still only one goal away from going through. So, you know, Dost might be an option. It finished 1-1, which means Mainz are sixth, and as I mentioned, they're that hunt for the, I mean, Hertha are on 49 points, Rob in third. Leverkusen are fourth with 48 points. And then behind them, three-point gap to Gladbach and Mainz and Schalke.
I mean, dear Lord. And Hertha drew with Hanover, didn't they?
Yeah, Hertha, exactly. So Hertha have been in that top four basically all season, but you can make a case for five teams chasing the final two Champions League places.
Absolutely. Okay, a quick one in the Rhine derby in Cologne. It finished Köln 0. Leverkusen 2, Javier Hernandez on the score sheet. Wonderful goals from Leverkusen, in fact. Julian Brandt also scoring. Hernandez, 25 for the season, just two short of Rooney and Martial put together. And Julian Nagelsmann, the 28-year-old head coach of Hoffenheim, looks like he's keeping them in the Bundesliga. They were bottom when he took over.
Yeah, extraordinary. Won three of their last four, including at the weekend. Hoffenheim, 2-0 away at Eintracht Frankfurt. I mean, that's a bold call from the board. You have to, you know, give huge credit. They're a club who have, you know, done things differently from day one, haven't they? They're that story from, you know, coming from absolutely nowhere as a football club.
A village of 3,000 people. And yeah.
But you always wonder when those teams go down, or if they go down, you know, where do they go from there? But Hoffenheim quite possibly will stay up. They're still only 3 points above Werder Bremen. But I think, again, what's interesting in the Bundesliga, you've got teams like Ingolstadt, Darmstadt, Hoffenheim, who may all stay up. And then you look at the bottom three big traditional names, Hanover,
absolutely,
Eintracht Frankfurt and Werder Bremen. Those three go down. They're big old names. It's not a changing of the guard at the top, but certainly in terms of some of the other teams.
Ingolstadt have been fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not pretty, but they get results.
Yeah, well, there we go. But we've seen it in the Premier League, haven't we? The likes of Villa going down and maybe Newcastle, and then teams like Bournemouth and
Watford, yeah. Good comparison, yeah.
You know.
Do you want to say a little fact file on Julian Nagelsmann while we're talking about him? So he's picked up 17 points as Hoffenheim boss. Only Dortmund and Bayern have picked up more points in that time since he's been manager of the club. Pep Guardiola is his role model, but he was actually worked with Thomas Tuchel when he was reserve coach at Augsburg. Nagelsmann was his opposition scout, would look at the opposition team, and he was even an assistant head coach of Hoffenheim when he was 25. Thomas Tuchel's praised him, says he thinks he will deliver as a coach, and we're seeing that. And obviously he took over from Huub Stevens, who was ill earlier in the season. Nagelsmann was going to take over at the end of the season regardless, but he stepped in and I don't think he's quite got all his coaching badges yet either, but the German league have said it's fine till the end of the season. But my word, he's doing a sensational job and maybe keeping Hoffenheim in the league.
He is. One other thing I remembered I needed to say from the Bundesliga. Have you seen the pictures of Kevin Grosskreutz and Marco Reus?
Oh,
Reus
yeah, in Liverpool kits.
In the 2001 final, before that bonkers game against Alaves. And they're two of the mascots. So they're in Liverpool kits because they're standing in front of the Alaves players.
Yeah.
Great. You can see, honestly, Marco Reus I was like, is that really Marco Reus?
Oh, no, you can see it, don't you think? Well, tweet it out. I'm sure people have seen this anyway if they use Twitter. But no, it looks like Reus, don't you think? Kevin Grosskreutz looks basically the same dude.
Yeah, that's
but Reus
what I mean.
Does look different.
And he's got that classic haircut of the basically the bowl on top. And
yeah,
then the
your parents have picked it. Yeah, exactly. So they're signing for Liverpool, obviously, now. And let's move on to talk about matters in Turkey and Russia.
For more, head to the website, footballineurope.co.uk.
OK, joining us now to talk about all things Russian, Ukrainian and Turkish football is goal.com writer Elliot Rothwell. Elliot, hello.
Hello.
You had a blood test today. You're not gonna faint on us.
I'm fine. I didn't faint. It was all good.
That's good. A real man. That's good. Well, let's talk about Turkish football first. Beşiktaş have got a new stadium. Me and Chris actually visited that the old stadium before. We somehow managed to get in when it wasn't a match day, and that was a really charming ground. What's the new one like?
Well, the new one looks fantastic. It's in the same place that the old Inonu Stadium is, right on the banks of the Bosphorus. And it looks brilliant. It's around 40,000 that they're gonna. Well, they opened it officially yesterday, but it wasn't actually in the stadium. It was kind of outside in a director's part where a lot of functionaries from the Turkish football and around came. President Erdogan was there. But the official opening, the proper where the fans get to go, is tonight against Bursaspor. So I imagine it'll be kind of a carnival atmosphere. The hashtag that Beşiktaş has been putting out is coming home, welcome home, because for the past couple of years, they've been really kind of as far away as possible inside Istanbul than they could get from where their home is. They've been at the Atatürk, which is way out west in the city. And I mean, I used to live quite near Beşiktaş, the area and where the stadium is. And it takes, on public transport, it can take anything from 1.5 to 2 hours to get there. So it's a real drag away. And it's kind of one of these stadiums that's not linked to a community or anything. It's just in the middle of nowhere, basically. It's not a great place to play football. It's not a great place to be a fan. So they're very happy that they've managed to get this stadium open eventually.
It's probably Liverpool fans who have the greatest affection.
Exactly, yeah.
So Fenerbahçe Galatasaray, huge derby in Istanbul, is being played this week. Now, this game was postponed, wasn't it, Elliot? You used to live in Istanbul, as you mentioned. Do you want to just explain everything that's happened with this game and how sad have you been by the recent events in Istanbul?
Well, the day that it was called off was quite a weird day. It was the weekend that the bombing was on Istiklal Street, which is, if anyone's been to Istanbul, it's kind of the main tourist part of new Istanbul. It's not near Hagia Sophia and the Blue Mosque and that. It's the main bit where commercial activity goes on, where you'd find a Nike store and shops like that. So there's hundreds of thousands of people who walk down that street every weekend, which was why it was such a shock that the bombing took place there, because it's such a, anyone who's been to Istanbul really can relate to that. And anyone who's lived in Istanbul will, I mean, I used to go down there probably 3-4 times a week. So it's a real shock that it happened in such a obvious place, in such a place that a lot of people use daily throughout their normal lives. So the game was on the Sunday, I think it was, or was supposed to be on the Sunday. And I heard a few kind of rumors that it was going to be called off when the bomb actually took place, but nothing happened. They waited and waited. And then it was eventually about 50 minutes before the game was due to kick off. There was an announcement apparently from the tannoy outside the Galatasaray Stadium saying that no fans were going to be allowed in for security reasons. But at that stage, the game was still going to go ahead. And then 20 minutes later, they'd completely changed their mind and the game was off. So they'd already sent the fans home. So there's quite a lot of fans making their way back from Galatasaray Stadium, which is in the north of the city. And then they just completely called the game off and now it's being replayed tonight. So I imagined that there was they said that there was a credible security threat, which is why it was called off, which seems quite sensible. I mean, I know a lot of people were annoyed because they already made the trip up there, but you can't take any risks in a situation like this. So it was probably the most sensible thing to call it off and replay it at a later date, which is obviously this week.
It's going to be a fascinating game. Galatasaray, 20-odd points behind Beşiktaş and Fenerbahçe. What's the story there? Why have they been so bad?
Well, I think a lot of people at the club, especially, are scratching their heads, sorry, as to why they've been so bad. But there are quite a few factors that you can see that are quite clear to, like, the observer as why they've been so bad. Since the old president, Aysel, left in 2015, they've really just been on a downward spiral. He appointed Mancini, he appointed Fatih Terim, which was the last league title winner. And just the players that they've signed, the investment that they've given has just not been up to scratch to, and not comparable to the likes of Fenerbahce and Besiktas. I mean, if you look at who Galatasaray have signed in the past few years, it's been Goran Pandev and Lucas Podolski, which doesn't compare to Nani and Robin van Persie. It's just not comparable. They've just let the squad fall into disrepair. I mean, one of the big signings this summer, or the previous summer, was Cem Karacan from Reading. I mean, and it's not, that's not a, he's not a Galatasaray player. I mean, he's out on loan now, so it just showed that it was just a mindless decision. But they've just, a lack of investment, basically, and as it looks like, the head honchos, Dursun Özbek, now the new president, it just kind of looks like they've lost interest. They're not investing, they're not running the club well, and obviously now they've been banned from European competition.
They have indeed. Let's move on to things Russia now. I commentated on Zenit's 2-0 win at Amkar Perm at the weekend. Alexander Kokorin with his first goal for the club after joining from Dynamo Moscow. Andrei Velesboas has got his side back in the title race, Elliot. They looked out of it at the midway point in the season, but he is leaving at the end of the season. And from what I've read, who are the big names being linked with taking over in St. Petersburg?
The main one, but this was in the English press rather than the Russian press, was Manuel Pellegrini, who a few months ago, kind of a group of newspapers and journalists published stories saying that Pellegrini had been offered a 2-year deal. But that wasn't widely reported in the Russian press. And strangely, usually when, obviously, Villas-Boas has announced that he's going to leave and he still intends to leave, he said this week that he's going to have a sabbatical for a year rather than take over anywhere. Usually there's a lot of rumours that come out in the press about who's going to be appointed, but it's been quite quiet. So that to me says that Zenit aren't sure themselves where they're going to go, who they're going to appoint. So they've not been briefing any of the Russian media as to who they're looking at. So Pellegrini is the only solid name at the minute, but unless that's all wrapped up so they don't need to leak any more names or anything, or nothing else has been reported, the it seems that they've not made a complete decision one way or the other.
It's a really interesting title race. I commentated on Ciska, who, having beaten Mordovia 6-4 in September, won 7-1 against the same team. It was a mad game. Leonard Slutsky is job sharing with Ciska and the Russian national team. Where are Russia ahead of Euro then? Of course, they open up against England in St Etienne on the 11th of June.
Well, it looks quite promising, actually, at the minute. I mean, Slutsky is basically the most talented coach of his generation in Russia. He's brilliant. He's combined both jobs and hasn't really suffered for either of them. When he took over, Russia were in quite a bad state. Capello had kind of thrown the qualifying process for Euro 2016. It looked like they were out of it, and Slutsky just came in and they've not stopped winning since. And I think it's been useful that he is the manager of kind of the core of the side at CSKA. I mean, a lot of the defenders and midfielders for the Russian national team come from CSKA, and the goalkeeper as well, Igor Akinfeyev. The kind of wingers and the strikers are mainly made up by Zenit, but the fact that he works with the players that will make up his core every day can only be a positive thing. And now that he's brought in Roman Shirokov from Spartak Moscow, where he fell out with the managerial board, like he falls out with the managerial board at every club he's ever been at. He's a Russian captain, and the fact that he's now working with Slutsky day to day means that it can translate quite easily. So I think that definitely Russia will be the biggest test for England in the Euro 2016 group, and I expect them to go through the group ahead of Wales and Slovakia, really.
Yeah, there was a couple of interesting things for me at the weekend. Sergei Ignashevich had been dropped by Slutsky for two games, and he brought him back in, which, given that he's supposed to be one of his number one centre-backs, along with Vasily Berezutsky for Euro, was important. And also, Alexander Golovin scored his first goal for Ciska. He's part of a golden generation of youngsters as well, isn't he? Because they reached the final of the Under-19 Championship last year, and the Under-17 Championship 2 years ago. So with the World Cup in Russia as well, things, as you mentioned, do look pretty bright.
Yeah, I mean, CSKA, well, Spartak Moscow as well, actually, about 10 years ago, invested a lot in their youth academies, because at that time they weren't winning that many titles. Spartak still haven't kind of got up to the level that they were in the 90s with Oleg Romantsev. But in the next few years, I imagine there'll be quite a few coming through. And as you say, Golovin just looks sensational. I think he was, in the last round of international friendlies, he scored twice, I think, and he became the first player to score on his first two consecutive international games since, I think, it was the 70s. So he's a real bright prospect, and I expect that he'll Well, actually, saying that, I was going to say I expect he'll move to one of the big clubs in Europe, but Russian players tend to stay where they are. There aren't that many talented Russian players playing in Western European football. They kind of stay at home.
Yeah, great to see if he does start in that opening against England. Lastly, we can't speak about Russian football without mentioning Rostov. I guess the Russian Leicester might be a lazy journalist way of describing them, but it would be incredible if they managed to win the league. Knocked off top spot of the weekend. They drew with Anchi and Siska won, as I mentioned, 7-1. But the fact that they're in and around the top four, the top two, is amazing.
Yeah, it's absolutely balmy, really. I mean, you say that calling them the Russian Leicester is lazy journalism, but on the commentary on the Russian state TV last week, they said Ruski Leicester. So it's catching on.
That's great.
So it's definitely the Russian Leicester is kind of sticking. It's been a really strange story, really. I mean, Kerbin Berdiev is the manager there, who was the manager of Rubin Kazan when they won their set of titles in the last decade, and when they beat Barcelona in the Champions League, which is their kind of their biggest result in their history, I suppose. And he fell out with the board at Rubin, was kind of unemployed for a while, not really doing much. He's gone down to Rostov on near the Black Sea coast, and it's got a bit of a feel of getting the band back together, because he's brought a few players that helped him win the title with Rubin. I mean, Bukharov, the big striker, is there. Christian Naboa, who's a great player, and I don't really know what he's doing at Rostov. He should be a miles better team than them. He's down
absolutely,
there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And Cesar Navas as well, who was at Rubin with him. So it has been a similar story to Leicester. It's unfancied players with an unfancied manager that many thought was past his best, and they've just come together, and it's been a great story, really. I mean, I'm quite sad that they've fallen off the top now, and I think with the momentum that Zenit have got and the firepower that CSKA have got, I think they may fall away. But if they can get into Europe, it'll still have been a remarkable season.
And a very quick one, Elliot. Shakhtar Donetsk, do you see them potentially winning the Europa League this season?
I'd love it if it happened, because it'd be great for the city and the people there. Obviously, they're going through a lot at the minute with the war. They're now playing in Lviv, which is like a 16-hour drive from Donetsk. So they're basically really detached from what's going on for safety reasons, because they have to be. They've got a few good players. That the squad isn't as good as the one that won the UEFA Cup as it was then in 2009, when they had Fernandinho and Willian in the starting lineup. But they've got a few useful players. I expect them to go through against Braga, because obviously they're 2-1 up from the first leg, and that was away.
Yeah.
I really like Marlos, who scored against Anderlecht. I don't know if you saw that goal, but it was a cracking goal. And they, much like CSKA of Golovin, they've got a bright young thing in central midfield called Viktor Kovalenko, who's really come out of nowhere. Nobody expected him to be figuring the starting lineup at the start of this season, but he's come out of nowhere, and he now looks like he'll make Ukraine's Euro 2016 squad. So things are looking up for Shakhtar, despite the real horrendous circumstances that they're playing in at the minute.
Elliot, great to get your insight. Thanks for coming back on the podcast.
No problem. Thank you.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
Oh, we're running out of time on Football in Europe. Too much to talk about. Chris, let's talk about France next. Ugly scenes at Marseille at the weekend as they drew 0-0 at home to Bordeaux. They haven't won at the Velodrome in the league since September, and fans are probably rightly a bit annoyed.
Yes, to say the least. And when Marseille fans are annoyed, you know, about it, it was eye-catching, shall we say. First of all, they had a portrait of 11 goats running around the stands to Benny Hill's theme music, which is novel.
Let's play that now. I never thought we'd get that on the podcast. Isn't that pleasing?
But yeah, I mean, I do love it when football fans come up with things like this. I just like the idea of them just sitting around.
Yeah, when do they come?
Goats? Yeah, do it. Done.
Benny Hill?
Benny Hill. Oh, le Benny Hill. goats in France are similar to donkeys in England, isn't
it? Okay, right.
Derogatory term. There was also a very offensive and sexist, frankly, banner against the club owner, Margarita Louis Dreyfus. So things just are spiralling. Ever since Bielsa left and all that contract problems, basically
it's been a mess.
Basically didn't have one, and then he left, and he's Marseille fans and Marcelo Bielsa was just a marriage made in heaven. And as soon as he left, if things didn't go well, you knew it was going to degenerate, and it really has.
Yeah, the club confirming this week Mitchell will stay until the end of the season after meetings in Zurich, but I don't think they're very happy about it. Hatem Ben Arfa banged in a hat-trick for Nice against Rennes. His third goal, absolutely wonderful. He's on 16 league goals for the season, and surely he's off to the European Championships in France. Lots going on at the top in terms of the challenge for Champions League football. Lyon moving up to second in the table. A big win for Lille against Monaco as well. But Chris, Paris Saint-Germain basically rested the whole team for a 2-0 win at Guingamp. A lot of youngsters in the side. Lucas Moura did bang in a couple. He was one of the more senior members of the first team. But this all with Manchester City in mind. So what is the team news for PSG ahead of you know, their biggest game of the season?
Yeah, massive game. And for all of Laurent Blanc's achievements, if they get knocked out, that'd be big questions, we can guarantee.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think they will, just because of the expectations. David Luiz and Matuidi are suspended, which means at the back, he's probably going to have to play Marquinhos, who... he's not particularly happy with Blanc, if you believe L'Equipe and a lot of the French press. He wants out. I mean, fair enough. I think he's an outstanding young centre-half. And first of all, he sees David Luiz playing in front of him.
Well, that's a point.
And then even when there's another spot up at centre-back in their biggest game of the season, home to City, he doesn't start. So he will come in. The bigger news is Marco Verratti. Kevin Trapp was injured. He is in injury doubt. Salvatore Sirigu would have to come in.
He came on at the weekend, Sirigu. Yeah.
So Trapp got injured in that game. Verratti is the bigger news, really. He's so important to them, particularly with Matuidi being out. He's going to have a test in training in Manchester Monday night, this evening. But he cannot be fully fit. And I think you were saying there was a L'Equipe headline.
Yeah, L'Equipe's front page was Le Pari Fou, the crazy gamble, crazy bet, if you like, for Verratti to play against Manchester City. Because with no Matuidi, there's a hole in.
Yeah.
And they might play Stambouli, who had that brief spell at Tottenham. But, you know, absolutely massive game. 2-2 from the first leg. Who's going to go through, Chris?
I think Manchester City.
It's a great scoreline to go in with, isn't it? 2-2.
Yeah. And yeah. I still think they've gone under the radar. They won't as of Tuesday night in the Champions League this season. But yeah, I think they might. And who knows, because we're going to get onto Wolfsburg in a moment. But imagine Wolfsburg win and City get Wolfsburg in the semi-finals.
Oh, could happen. PSG, meanwhile, could lead the likes of Thiago Silva, Angel Di Maria, Thiago Motta, Ibrahimovic, Pastore and Cavani. All in Paris. They didn't even go to Guingamp, so they can be fully fresh for the game. Ibrahimovic wants a series of movies about himself in the style of Rambo 1-5 as well, which he says he wants to have total control of. We can talk about that more next week, because we've got Chris, who's going through in each Champions League tie. We're going to do this. Do you fancy doing this quick fire?
Yep.
Okay, so Atletico 2-1 down to Barcelona.
Barcelona after extra time.
Oh, specific. Benfica 0, Bayern 1.
Bayern will score, so Benfica would need to score 3, and Jonas is suspended, so Bayern.
And the final one is Real Madrid, Wolfsburg.
Real Madrid. I think Wolfsburg will score. I think Real Madrid can score 4 goals. That could be an absolute corker.
I think Karim Benzema's been training after picking up an injury in that game, but it looks like he should be okay to play. Europa League, we'll talk about Dortmund-Liverpool in a moment. Give me the 3 other semi-finalists who you think are going through, and a reminder of the ties.
Okay, Shakhtar Donetsk will go through against Braga, a 2-1 up from the first leg, ahead of the return in Ukraine. Villarreal leads Sparta Prague 2-1. I think Villarreal will have enough to go through. Sevilla, they're going to be in the semi-finals again. I mean, it's getting boring.
A 2-1 win at Bilbao in the first leg.
Yeah, I can't see them throwing that away. It might be their only route, certainly back into the Champions League, potentially this season.
Absolutely.
They're on for 3 titles in a row, which is, I mean, that is extraordinary.
They love it.
They love it. And I think Dortmund will go through against Liverpool.
Do you?
I think they can easily score 2 goals, which I think would...
You just need a free kick round the box and whip it into the middle. I mean, Liverpool conceded another goal like that at the weekend to Bojan, who's like the tiniest little dude.
Yeah.
The set piecing is just extraordinary. It'll be a great atmosphere at Anfield, as we'll come to expect. But I think Liverpool are going to go through. I think
really?
Klopp's going to do a number. Yeah, I think he's going to work it out.
Yeah.
Just win the game. Don't worry about all this.
No, agreed.
Continue. Just go out and win the game.
I think
it's not going to go. It's not going to be 0-0, is it? Surely
no, it can't be. Not with that. It can't because Liverpool cannot. They're not good enough at the back to be able to do that. And Klopp knows it. I think it'd be great. It's brilliant. They're playing each other. It is. Would have loved it to have been maybe the semi-final, but you can't have everything. It's great. It's great that they have actually played.
That it's happening at all. Okay, so that's all we have time for on Football in Europe. Christian, mind if I plug the other show I was on?
Oh, Christian. Turncoat. Yes, of course.
You can download Eurovision, the new TalkSport European football show with Danny Kelly. I was on that on Sunday night. It's a lot of what we talked about today, but we've expanded on some stuff, and there's some stuff about Euro 2016 as well. But the main thing is you subscribe to this show. tweet us at FIE Podcast. Leave us a review on iTunes. Chris, who's winning the Champions League?
Barcelona.
Don't know why I did that to you.
Manchester City. Imagine said that. Imagine they win the Champions League.
Oh, my God.
They'll be unbearable.
we'll be back next Monday.
This is Football in Europe.